A City Called Confusion, Commentary for the May 27th, 2023 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain, great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Revelation 21, verses 9 and 10. In 1859, 2 years before the American Civil War, Charles Dickens published a novel, A Tale of Two Cities, set in the milieu of the French Revolution that had taken place 70 years prior. In his novel, an English barrister, Sidney Carton, dissolute and disillusioned with life, becomes acquainted with Charles Darnay. Using an alias, Charles has nonetheless been recognized during the Reign of Terror as a member of the French nobility, a Saint Evremond. Denounced and imprisoned, Charles is to be sent to the guillotine. However, Sidney's unrequited love for Charles' wife, Lucy, and his close resemblance to Charles brings him to decide to forsake the safety of London and travel to Paris, the titular two cities, where he switches places with Charles, and while he accepts the guillotine in place of the nobleman, Charles and Lucy find safety in London. During his sacrifice, he intones one of the most famous quotes to be found in literature. "It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known." Some have called A Tale of Two Cities the greatest novel ever written. This is not surprising, for it echoes elements of the greatest story ever told, a story that was retold in a 1965 movie of the same name starring Max von Sydow. The movie explores a biblical sacrifice where an innocent Jesus died upon a cross to save others from eternal death. Some may question any equivalency between Sidney and Jesus, but Jesus was also seen by his critics as dissolute in his day. Man tends to judge others based on appearances that may reveal little to nothing of the state of the heart. Sidney's sacrifice was driven by his love for Lucy. Jesus' sacrifice was also driven by love, a love that, like Sidney's, is often unrequited as well. Because God created us in his image to love and be loved, stories like this appeal to something deep within us. We're challenged with the question whether we would do the same for another, or conversely, whether anyone would love us enough to make such a sacrifice on our behalf. The New Testament assures us that is what Jesus did. It challenges us in a way that a novel can never achieve. When fantasy becomes reality, it is no longer just a story, not even the greatest story. It becomes an indictment of us and our choices to know that someone rose to a higher morality than we have ever invoked. The similarities do not end there. The entire Bible, although a disparate collection of stories, is essentially a tale of two cities, Babylon and Jerusalem. According to Genesis, Babylon, or Babel, depending on the translation, was established by Nimrod of the second generation born after the flood. He was the son of Cush, the son of Ham, the son of Noah. This was the Tower of Babel where the Bible tells us the languages were born. Hence the city Babylon became associated with confusion from all the different languages. It is significant to note that the city of Ur, where the Bible tells us Abram was from, was part of the Babylonian realm under Nimrod. Some Jewish sources present the idea that Terah, Abram's father, was a high-ranking supporter of Nimrod. Because of our limited lifespans and our definition of time spans between generations, this does not seem likely. However, if we examine the biblical record consistent with the lifespans claimed for that period, what seemed impossible becomes plausible. Though traceable back to Cain and Abel, the conflict between good and evil, symbolized by the two cities represented by Jerusalem and Babylon, seems to show the genesis of that symbolism with Nimrod and with Terah and Abram's departure from the Babylonian realm. The Bible does not tell us when Jerusalem was founded, but various archaeological sources reveal possibilities as early as the 19th century BCE. While it may be even earlier, no evidence for that has been discovered to date. The 19th century date is based on execration writings listing Egypt's enemies from that period. Although such texts go back to the 23rd century BCE, writing that could confirm the existence of Jerusalem has thus far only been found from the 19th. When the Bible mentions Jerusalem, it is referred to as a Jebusite city. The Jebusites, like Nimrod, were descendants of Ham, but through Canaan rather than Cush. They would have been cousins to Nimrod. In any event, Jerusalem remained a Jebusite city until the time of King David, when he conquered the city for Israel. And eventually a temple was built to house the various holy objects from the wilderness tabernacle, including the Ark of the Covenant. At that point, Jerusalem became established as a city of God. Despite the heady idealism of that reputation, Jerusalem has seen much ungodliness perpetrated in her streets. From the widespread bloodshedding of King Manasseh to the murder of Jesus, it is hard to derive a representation of the loving character of God from such atrocities. Even more recently, during the Crusades, when Christians took Jerusalem, they slaughtered Jews and Muslims alike, setting alight fires of hatred and revenge that still reverberate today. With such a foundation, there is little wonder that Jerusalem seems anything but the love of God to many. Despite the failure of so many believers to manifest love and compassion for others, things they sometimes do not even display to one another, a thread of connection to the presence of God remains, at times glowing brightly through the prophecies of the Old Testament and their apparent fulfillment, the words of Jesus, and the highly symbolized promises of Revelation. We should be careful of our understanding of that, however. We have a narcissistic tendency to conflate some of the symbolism for self-serving purposes. For instance, it is too often said that the prophetic symbolism of a woman in the Bible is the church, even to the extent of portraying the church as the bride of Christ, something the Bible never says. The Bible says that the New Jerusalem is the bride of Christ, as in our opening text, not the church. It is a height of effrontery to claim that one's dogma makes their church the bride of Christ. If we were to construct a Venn diagram for those inside any particular denomination and those outside of it, we may find a point where both intersect as eventual inhabitants of the New Jerusalem, but it is highly unlikely that any denomination would be congruent with the New Jerusalem in such a diagram. We may not realize it, but we even admit this when, as a denomination, we establish processes for church discipline. If sainthood were established by denominational affiliation, such processes would not be necessary. The symbolism path has some claiming that a white, radiant woman, such as we find in Revelation chapter 12, represents God's true church, and the scarlet and purple-clad woman of Revelation represents an apostate church, an appellation conveniently applied to any group of believers who do not adhere to the dogma of the denomination doing the interpreting. Such vilification is often the precursor to persecution. Centuries of government-sanctioned persecutions by both Catholics and Protestants, depending on which power controlled the government, is a primary reason for the Establishment Clause in the United States Constitution, prohibiting the government from backing one religion or sect over another. This is a source of frustration for those who believe that their dogma is the truth, and all others are apostates who will be ultimately destroyed, even if they cannot be touched now because of a democratically elected government that either is apostate itself or simply doesn't understand how apostates should be dealt with. While those winds of strife are restrained for now, Revelation indicates they will not be held back forever. Even today, the triple threat of dominionism, triumphalism, and nationalism are joining hands to bring about a Christian fundamentalist heaven on earth. They do not understand that the very processes they are engaging in to accomplish this negates the need for any new Jerusalem or new earth, as foretold in Revelation. It also ignores the promise that the earth and the works up until the parousia will be destroyed. To what end will their works be then? This is why Jesus spoke so much about love. Love is impervious to flames. It persists despite apocalyptic challenges. It persists despite persecution. When we look at the various governments now in existence, no matter what type of government people are under, in diverse locations and through varied means, love continues. That is why the Bible and novels like A Tale of Two Cities touch us. Love endures. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find the written version of this commentary, along with the footnotes that support the ideas shared in this commentary, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find hundreds more commentaries and podcasts at that location. Again, that's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.